almost running out of time, so I'll be quick. This has all come just as the SNP is trying to breathe new life into its demands for independence. That's what Swinney's been talking about. Has that effectively, because of all this, crashed on takeoff?
Well, I think it wasn't going anywhere anyway, but it is certainly obvious that this isn't the way that John Swinney would like to begin the new parliamentary term after last month's elections to the Scottish Parliament. You know, that this is the only subject that anybody in Scotland is talking about at the moment. It has cut through to the general public like few other stories in Scottish politics in recent years. And so, you know, until the SNP come up with some better answers than those they've provided thus far, I would expect this to run and run, although, it won't necessarily dent enthusiasm for independence in the long term, but in the short to medium term and so on, it is very bad news for John Swinney and the SNP.
I can understand that. It will be back to you, Alex, as this story develops, particularly for June 23rd. Big day, put it in the diary. Alex Massey in Edinburgh, thank you for that. That's it for me today. I'll be back 1 o'clock tomorrow, but coming up now, it's Jane Garvey and Feed Lover.
Across the UK, on DAB, on your smart speaker, and now in the Times Live app on your mobile and tablet. This is Times Radio.
2 o'clock. Don't forget, Andrew Neil back with the Times at 1 tomorrow. It is now the afternoon show. Here are Jane Garvey and Fee Glover to delight you until 4 o'clock.
And part of that delight is this. We'll talk politics as Kemi Badenoch accuses Nigel Farage of whipping people up following the murder of 18-year-old Henry Novak. We'll head to Scotland. A court has heard how the former SNP chief executive spent those £400,000. Paralympian surgeon and now astronaut Rob McFall could be the first disabled man in space. He's going to join us in about 15 minutes' time. And our big guest after 3:30 is the mighty John Barnes to tell us what he thinks England's prospects are in the World Cup.
Here's the news at 2 o'clock. Rob Malarkey.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. Nigel Farage says the arrest of a student minutes before he died of a stab wound shows that racism is regarded by the police as more serious than murder. The Reform UK leader said the rights and privileges of white people matter less than those of minorities after footage was released of police arresting Henry Novak for alleged racial abuse. Vikram Digwa had attacked the 18-year-old student with a ceremonial dagger in Southampton last December before telling police officers Novak had racially abused him. Speaking in the Commons in the last half hour, the Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood addressed those accusations.
There have been accusations, I know, of two-tier policing. It will be for the IOPC to determine the facts with regard to this specific case, and I cannot and will not comment on them. But let me say this on the question of preferential treatment more widely. The police in this country have a sacred duty to police without fear or favour. Everyone in this country is equal before the law.
The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, has accused Farage of whipping up anger and division. More details of the crimes committed by the former SNP chief executive Peter Murrell have been outlined at the High Court in Edinburgh. Murrell pleaded guilty last week to embezzling more than £400,000 from the party. Nicola Sturgeon, who's estranged from Murrell, says that he deceived and betrayed her when he used party funds to buy luxury goods. Prosecutors have set out how he created fake invoices to cover his offences. At least 18 people are now known to have been killed in what the Russian military said was a massive strike across Ukraine. At least half of the fatalities occurred in the eastern city of Dnipro, including a young child and an emergency worker. Katerina Malofieva is a journalist in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv.
Rescue works are still ongoing because it was six districts of Kyiv were under the attack, so a lot of buildings are still, they're damaged, and the rescue are still continuing rescue work over there. They keep bombarding the civilian population.
Russia had warned last week that it would carry out a large-scale assault. President Trump has told Benjamin Netanyahu that everybody hates Israel during an expletive-ridden call with the Israeli Prime Minister. According to reports, the US president was responding to Israeli attacks on Lebanon that are threatening to collapse peace talks with Iran. Lebanon said Hezbollah had accepted an American-backed proposal that would see it stop firing on Israel in exchange for planned Israeli strikes on southern Beirut being called off. UK Athletics has been fined £350,000 over the death of a Paralympian who was killed when a practice cage at a London leisure centre collapsed on his head. Abdullah Hayaye, who was 36 and a father of five, was preparing to represent the United Arab Emirates at the World Athletics Championships in London when the cage fell on him at Newham Leisure Centre in 2017. The court ruled the cage toppled over because it had been put up incorrectly. And Sir Kenny Dalglish says he has been diagnosed with cancer. The Liverpool, Celtic and Scotland greats inadvertently posted on social media that he was undergoing treatments, which prompted him to follow up with a lengthier statement. In self-deprecating fashion, he said, "Unlike my mobile phone use, the treatment is going well." For a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
It's coming up to 5 minutes past two. Welcome aboard the afternoon show bus. Jane and I are here until 4 o'clock this afternoon. We're going to start with politics with Rob Hutton, parliamentary sketchwriter and political journalist. Busy times for them. Farage has said that the Henry Novak murder is a George Floyd moment. He says it shows a two-tier policing system in this country where police take more note of racial abuse than of murder. Now, his critics are staunch in their rebuttals of all of that. And Henry's family have said that they don't want their son's death to be treated as a political football. More on that in just a moment. What are your thoughts about it? 0333 003 2353. Could John McFall be the first disabled astronaut in space? That is a question for us too at about 20 minutes past the hour. He's a former NHS surgeon and Paralympian, and he's going to tell us about what could be and should be the trip of a lifetime. What do we learn about the manosphere from football, and particularly when football is being taught to young boys? How can it help them to not enter the world of brutal misogyny and weird tropes of what being a man actually is? We will have more on Peter Morrill's extraordinary shopping list after 3 o'clock this afternoon. And also we'll consider, have Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu lost their friendship status? They've had a beyond tetchy phone call overnight. So what does that mean for the Middle East? And after 3:30, sit back and relax, because we will look ahead to England men's greatness at the World Cup with a legend.
You got to hold and give, but do it at the right time. You can be slow or fast, but you must get to the line. They'll always hit you and hurt you, defend and attack. There's only one way to beat them, get round the back. Catch me if you can, cause I'm the England man. And what you're looking at is the master plan. We ain't no hooligans, they say the football.
So I think now might be the time to have one of Ryan's fantastic super fades.
There we are.
There it is.
Very cool. That's for all the Scotland fans.
No, don't start it up again. Don't.
Thank you, Ryan. He has, John Barnes, he is a great. I'm very excited that he's coming into the studio, I think, after half past three this afternoon. He has recreated that song, which incidentally is way better than that other old dirge that comes out every single time. Oh, it's terrible. World in Motion is the best football song ever. He's re-recorded a new version in celebration of watching football in the pub for this year's World Cup. And the new lyric, the new rap goes, "You've got to hold your pint, but be there for kickoff time. You're here to back your team, but staying home is a crime. They're always shouting and singing through defence and attack. You're always welcome inside. It's sunny round the back." Beautiful, isn't it?
I mean, it's good rhyme.
Yes. Not so much Andrew Motion as World Emotion. Get it? Anyway, John Barnes with us after 3:30. And there's
That's
no
such a joke for the Times Radio.
I know,
listener.
Well, I'm doing my best.
It's great on brand.
Yeah, absolutely. That there's no. I'm getting excited. It's tragic, but I am getting excited. The World Cup doesn't actually start till June the 11th, but I think we're slightly excited, more excitable, because we're in the Talksport area of this building, and it's just joy a go go up here. Right, to the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. At number three, MAGA influencer admits assault over racist incident in London. Melissa Rain Lively has agreed to pay compensation over a hair-pulling incident outside Bond Street tube station. The second most read story, Sir Kenny Dalglish, Liverpool legend, reveals cancer diagnosis. The former player and manager says his treatment is going well and that he did intend to keep the diagnosis private before revealing it in what he calls an inadvertent social media post. Well, we've all been there. And actually, John Barnes worked with Sir Kenny at Liverpool. I think he played alongside him, and then Kenny Dalglish was his manager. So we'll certainly mention that to John Barnes a bit later. And the most read piece on the Times website is Nigel Farage, Henry Novak case shows racism seen as more serious than murder. The Reform leader has likened the case to that of George Floyd after the release of police body cam footage. But the Tory leader, Kemi Badenoch, has accused Nigel Farage of sowing division. You can read all of these articles on thetimes.com. You will need a digital subscription, and you can get one by going to thetimes.com/subscribe.
And that most read story is where we will start this afternoon too. So the Home Secretary has condemned the murder of 18-year-old Henry Novak as an evil act. The student was handcuffed by officers as he was dying because his killer accused him of making a racist remark. Shabana Mahmood told MPs that proper process would be followed in the investigation of the case. Well, Robert Hutton is a political journalist and the parliamentary sketch writer for The Critic. Robert, a very good afternoon from us. This is such an awful case. We are going to talk about the politics of it, which by no means negates the emotions surrounding it. It's a personal tragedy for that family, and it will always be that way. Nigel Farage says we should all feel cold rage about what he sees as a two-tier policing system that isn't putting white victims first, calling it a national scandal. But the Novak family have asked for this not to become a political football, which seems to be exactly what the statement from Nigel Farage has done. And it's very unpleasant to watch this play out now. Do you think that Nigel Farage has made a political mistake?
Well, the notable thing about Farage's statement this morning, actually, was how he did it. Normally, 6 months ago, he would have done this in a speech with questions from the press afterwards and an audience. Reform were doing those certainly weekly, sometimes twice or three times a week. For the last month, Farage has been in hiding, and he gave this statement from a field somewhere, wherever it is that he is in hiding, because what he wants to move the conversation on from is questions about how that £5 million got into his bank account. And I think that what we're seeing today is an attempt to just change the subject to anything else. He doesn't want questions. That's why he's doing it in this way. I don't think he's in the Chamber of the Commons this afternoon. I'm not in there right now because I'm talking to you. Is it a mistake? I mean, Farage's calculation is that people who might support reform are more likely to sort of be susceptible to ideas of anti-white racism or two-tier policing or whatever. So maybe this is a dog whistle to appeal to his people. I think it's a problem for trying to widen the appeal of his party beyond that group, though.
Sure. I mean, the thing that strikes me, though, Robert, is that the family of Henry Novak have been so clear about what they see as their right, and it is their right to have dignity at this appalling time and for their son's memory to carry with it some dignity. And they have expressly said that they don't want this to become something political. I mean, does that message, when it reaches the same people that Nigel Farage has been reaching with his message, make Nigel Farage look, I mean, at the very best, insensitive, and at the very worst, manipulative of a horrible situation?
I think we will see how that plays out. I mean, I agree with you, absolutely. And the poor Novak family, very dignified statement yesterday, and obviously they can see how this might play out, and all of their words are about knife crime. And if you were watching Shabana Mahmood, who's just, well, actually she's still on her feet in the chamber, she was taking the knife crime challenge on, and that's been the Conservative Party response. I guess the reform view is, well, look, let's try and move the conversation to somewhere where they know the government is uncomfortable. I mean, I honestly don't think that, if you look at Nigel Farage's statement, that he would be unhappy if we had a race riot somewhere in the country in the next week or so. It was quite astonishing language that he's using.
Robert, it has been met with a very forceful rebuttal, hasn't it? Particularly from Kemi Badenoch, actually. Was she on ITV this morning?
Mm.
And she used the example of her own family, and she talked about her mixed-race son and said, you know, in 10 years' time, I don't want him to be out there in a world that sees his difference. I'm sending out the message to him that we're all part of one society. I mean, she couldn't have put her idea and her stance any more firmly or clearer, actually, I think.
Yeah, and she's actually been incredibly reluctant to get into this when Robert Jenrick was still in her party rather than in Reform. She chose not to criticise him when he talked about, you know, sort of Britain changing beyond recognition, going through a suburb of Birmingham and not seeing a white face and this kind of thing. When he was using that language, Kemi Badenoch didn't necessarily defend him, but she certainly didn't attack him, and she said that perhaps he's being misunderstood. It is interesting that she now feels, and I think she's right, that ultimately this... I think there has been a calculation by some people on the right that a lot of the sort of the stuff that's been going on from Reform and Restore and Farage and Lowe, it's all a bit dog whistly, they say, and really he's only talking about Muslims, he's not talking about Sikhs, he's not talking about Jews, he's not talking about black people. And I think slightly what we may be seeing today is a realization that, no, do you know what, it ends up being everyone. And and if you thought that this would stop with just being horrible to Muslims, then I'm sorry, you're wrong. Today it seeks, and I think Kemi Badenoch is right. We have to... I mean, I find it astonishing that I'm saying this in 2026. We cannot have this kind of dialogue happening in politics about, you know, two-tier policing and whether the police hate white. It's absolute nonsense.
Well, I tell you what, Robert, it's quite something when it feels cleansing to talk about Peter Mandelson, but that is also what we need to talk about this afternoon. So we've had a couple of hours to all digest what came out of those three tomes laid bare to us yesterday. I don't think we really learnt or were surprised, were we, by anything that we learnt about Peter Mandelson. I suspect that Pat McFadden had a difficult night.
Yes, I mean, we for years we've thought that we needed a name for the kind of scoop that, or the kind of sort of revelation that reveals that everything you thought was correct. So for the last couple of years, we've been looking at, certainly for the last 18 months, political journalists have been looking at what's going on in number 10 and thinking, doesn't really feel like Keir Starmer's got a grip on events, and it's not exactly clear what he thinks the government ought to be doing. And now it turns out that that's what everyone inside number 10 and inside the cabinet thought as well. So it's a scoop of, oh yes, they all agree it's exactly what it looked like from the outside. So I mean, it has to be said, however, highly amusing.
Yes, well, I mean, maybe not for some of the people affected by it. And the question that we've quite often posed, just, you know, outside of the broadcasting studios, is on a human level, Robert, I mean, why were people so happy to just completely look the other way over Peter Mandelson's past misdemeanours? I mean, you know, it wasn't like they were cloudy. They were quite obvious, weren't they? And is that just a toadying thing that you do in politics when you think that somebody's got the whiff of power about them again?
I think there's a tribal element to this, that the one thing that Mansfield has got going for him is that he is tribally Labour. And, you know, and he was out campaigning on the doorstep. And I guess if you hadn't really sort of got quite into exactly what it was that he had done with Epstein, you might have thought, oh, well, you know, Peter's always had dodgy friends, but he's one of us. I mean, I can't really explain it.
It is weird, though. And you've put your finger on something there, because I think in the outside world, if you know someone's got really dodgy friends, you tend to think, I don't think I want to be one of those dodgy friends, because everyone else is going to regard me as a dodgy friend. But that just doesn't seem to have happened with Peter Mandelson at all. Quite the opposite.
No, I mean... Maybe it was because a lot of the Epstein stuff was historic. Maybe it was easy. I mean, I am not for a single second defending the Prime Minister for appointing him when, you know, this is sort of literally the second thing I think that Number 10 said in the risks of appointing him was, oh, by the way, have you seen his Wikipedia page? But maybe they weren't following it closely. I am utterly, utterly baffled. I mean, you are seeing... Certainly there is a thing when somebody gets a job and everyone sends some lovely toadying messages. And I always struggle to do that kind of thing myself, so I don't quite understand it in other people. But, it's a point. I mean, what I did enjoy from the messages a lot was his campaign to be Oxford Chancellor, which is not having gone to Oxford myself, this passed me by. But it turns out that he was emailing everyone in his address book who had an Oxford degree to ask them to vote for him in a way that was utterly unsurprising and yet also sort of awful.
Yeah, and a bit sad. We'll leave it there, Robert. Nice to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed for sparing us the time in your busy day. It's Robin Hutton, who's a political journalist and the parliamentary sketch writer for The Critic. How many people in your address book, Jane, would you be able to message if you wanted to reach the alumni of Oxford?
Gosh, I'm afraid I probably know a terrifying number of people who went to Oxford. But like Rob, I'm not able to easily send a quick message congratulating somebody on some amazing job.
I would vouch for that.
Yeah. Thanks for your messages this afternoon. Josh, I find it genuinely horrifying that Farage could be our Prime Minister. Yet I feel we, you people in the media and myself, are in a bubble and his words will resonate more than some of us might wish. From Rich, I feel upset about what Nigel Farage has said today. He isn't somebody I admire. He's using this as a political football and I don't think he has the right to. Nick says, of course, the narrative you feel that Farage is pursuing is divisive, Jane and Fee. Ask yourselves, though, this question. Is it police protocol to automatically arrest and handcuff somebody as soon as they're accused of racism without questioning them and simply accepting the word of a complainant? There are lots of messages this afternoon. Many of you clearly very, very upset by this story. And certainly everyone I'm looking at extending their sympathy to the very dignified Novak family. It is Times Radio. It is 21 minutes past two. And next we're going to talk to a man who has been a Paralympian. He is a doctor and it looks like he could become an astronaut. What a guy. He's next on Times Radio, 22 minutes past two.
Wake up to Britain's brightest business bulletins with Times Radio business correspondent Dominic O'Connell.
For the latest business news and what it means for your money, join me, Dominic O'Connell, throughout breakfast every morning from 6.
Get expert insight and analysis in one essential breakfast briefing, Business Bulletins, with Times Radio business correspondent Dominic O'Connell on Times Radio. It's the business.
AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. That's why it's no surprise that more than 85% of the Fortune 500 use the ServiceNow AI platform. While other platforms duct tape tools together, ServiceNow seamlessly unifies people, data, workflows, and AI, connecting every corner of your business. And with AI agents working together autonomously, anyone in any department can focus on the work that matters most. Learn how ServiceNow puts AI to work for people at servicenow.co.uk.
McDonald's breakfast is turning up the heat with a spicy new twist. Calm down, not that spicy. Breakfast is for savouring, not suffering. Introducing McDonald's breakfast with Frank's Red Hot Ketchup. A spicy breakfast, suitable for the morning. Until 8th of June, served until 11 a.m, subject to availability.
The day's big stories and tomorrow's front pages, every night from 10 o'clock on Times Radio.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
I do want to be fair with the range of your opinions this afternoon. So Robin says Farage was a bit clumsy maybe with that statement, but I think he's absolutely right in calling out two-tier policing. Only people like your guest, that was Rob Hutton, can't see that. Holly says, I think we're missing the point if we focus on Farage's response to the police actions in the Henry Novak death. We should be focusing on the police and the awful, inhumane way they behaved in the last moments of that young man's life. Please do keep your thoughts coming. 0333 003 2353. Now to a quite exceptional individual. John McFall is an NHS surgeon. He is a decorated Paralympian. He won a medal for Team GB in 2008, and he could become the first disabled astronaut to go into orbit. It is part of a deal between the UK Space Agency and an American firm announced today, and John is able to talk to us. Hello, John, how are you?
Yeah, good afternoon. I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Now, tell us, first of all, what is the deal and what's the timescale here?
So the deal is actually as part of a broader agreement between the UK government and a company called VAST, which is a US commercial space company, specifically relating to me. It's an intention to fly me to the first commercial space station, Haven 1, which is being developed by VAST and is due to be launched in 2027 and to be crewed by astronauts in the second half of 2027. But it's part of a broader agreement between the UK government and VAST for the UK to support them in supplying space infrastructure and everything that is required for them to develop their commercial space station Haven 1 and beyond the next commercial space stations.
Can you tell us a bit about what will actually take place on this space station? Is it effectively a laboratory in space?
Yeah, you know, we're looking to do two main things, really. Generally, in terms of human space exploration, there's a couple of main themes. There is learning more about how we can live in space and explore space more. So doing science and understanding technology for the sake of exploration. So from my point of view, a really important part of this is no one with a physical disability has been a professional astronaut before. So actually, we want to understand if there are benefits or indeed disadvantages to being a lower limb amputee living and working in microgravity. So we will be doing some science surrounding that. But also, you know, when you look at living and working in low Earth orbit and going to space and human space exploration, we've got to always think of using space exploration for the benefit of us here on Earth as well. So we're looking into how the science that we can do in space, both related to my specific situation, but also unrelated to my specific situation, can provide solutions on Earth that can better humanity.
What will happen, John, in your case? Will you wear your prosthetic in space?
Yeah, this is it's a really good question, because a lot of people ask, well, you know, you're in microgravity, you don't really use your legs too much, so what is the problem with being an amputee and do you use your legs? Well, actually just living and working in space, don't know if wearing a prosthesis is going to be a hindrance or an advantage. Certainly the prosthetic I wear, it has a lot of programmability to it. So us not having any information as to how someone with an amputation may live and manage in space, having a piece of hardware that has a lot of programmability and adaptability to the environment would be quite useful to understand. Certainly during the launch phase, we know that it's important to have a prosthesis just in case there is an emergency on the launch pad for whatever reason, and you need to, in an emergency, escape from the spacecraft and get away from it.
Yeah. Okay, I must confess, I hadn't thought about that. That is the worst possible the worst possible set of circumstances, so let's not focus too much on that. What about your your feelings when you saw the incredible bond between the Artemis crew. What did that do to you? Because you're in a position where you could be one of those people.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, when you go to space, it's very much a team endeavor, right? Yes, you've got the teams on the ground supporting you and looking after you. But as a crew, you are the ones who are alone there in your space station, in your spacecraft. And it's really important that you guys have a bond and trust each other. And it's impossible not to, because the extremely close working environment that you have and the amount of training that you do together. And it's a, you know, it's a great testament to who we are as humans, right? Our ability to do this.
The Times today, I'm introducing another negative note. I don't really mean to. The Times has a story today about how spending too much time with your colleagues can put your mental health at risk. And it was actually illustrated with a picture of the Artemis II crew. But they did spend, admittedly, over a week in a capsule the size of a camper van. But they couldn't have gotten any better. Do you have any concerns at all about living in such close proximity to fellow, let's be honest, uber achievers like yourself?
No, I don't. I think one of the strengths of being an astronaut and when you go through the selection process for being an astronaut, there's a lot of psychological evaluation and they're trying to kind of understand the kind of person that you are. And they tend to pick people who are very resilient and able to deal with many, many different situations, but people who are also very good communicators. And so actually by having those skills, all of you having those skills when you're going into this situation, all of you are best placed to manage any difficulties that you might have as a crew together.
Can you tell us actually, as part of the this project with Haven, where will you take off from? Will it be from a NASA base?
So it will actually be, so the company is Vast and the project is Haven 1, the commercial space station will be Haven 1, but it won't be from a NASA base, it will be from SpaceX's launch pad in Florida. So it's very close to where NASA launched their rockets from, but because we would be flying on SpaceX's Crew Dragon spacecraft, it would be from there, but still out in Florida.
Right. Okay. And when you meet people for the first time, and they ask you to, I don't know, they just say, "Well, what do you do, John? Where do you start? Do you start with the Paralympic bit, the NHS surgeon part of your life, or the notion that you could be an astronaut?" What do you say?
I think primarily, I identify as a doctor. I think professionally, that's my job. That's what I love. That's where I feel comfortable. And I tend to just leave it at that.
Okay. Well, that in itself is rather impressive, I've got to say. John, all the very best to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks very much.
John McFall, who could be a British astronaut, the first disabled astronaut to go into orbit. That's quite something, isn't it?
What an extremely lovely example of humankind. It has just gone 2:30. After the news, we will talk about how football coaches could help fight back against the manosphere. Let's get the headlines first. So here's Rob Malarkey.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Good afternoon. Nigel Farage has been accused by the Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch of whipping up anger and division after claiming that a white teenager's murder proves Britain is a two-tier country. The Reform UK leader said the arrest of Henry Novak for alleged racial abuse minutes before he died of a stab wound shows that racism is regarded by the police as more serious than murder. Vikram Digwa, a 23-year-old Sikh man, had attacked the students with a ceremonial dagger in Southampton last December. Speaking in the Commons this afternoon, the Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood said people are rightly asking questions about how the situation was handled.
I know that it is difficult to wait any longer for answers, but there is a proper process to assess whether there have been incidents of police misconduct led by the Independent Office for Police Conduct, the IOPC. They will determine what could and should have been done differently. They will determine what action may need to be taken against individual officers.
The Home Secretary also said the IOPC's report will be delivered in 3 months. More details of the crimes committed by the former SNP chief executive Peter Murrell have been outlined at the High Court in Edinburgh. Murrell pleaded guilty last week to the embezzlement of more than £400,000 from the party. The court heard how Murrell falsified expenses claims and spent £124,000 on a luxury camper van that was passed off as a campaign vehicle. At least 18 people are now known to have been killed in a series of Russian military strikes across Ukraine. At least half of the fatalities occurred in the eastern city of Dnipro. And MPs are to begin their examination of the student loan system in England amid concern about high debt levels. Research suggests around a third of the British public think a university degree is no longer worth the money. The government says the current finance system protects lower earning graduates, while the charity Universities UK says it's doing more to help students prepare for their careers. Don't forget, you can set the Times Radio news briefing as your flash briefing on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
The quintessential Mackey's burger. The go-to you'll always go to. The new cheese and bacon McCrispy. 100% chicken breast, melty cheese, sizzling bacon. Betray your go-to for the new cheese and bacon McCrispy. McCrispy. Now at McDonald's. Served from 11 a.m. Subject to availability.
AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. That's why it's no surprise that more than 85% of the Fortune 500 use the ServiceNow AI platform. While other platforms duct tape tools together, ServiceNow seamlessly unifies people, data, workflows, and AI, connecting every corner of your business. And with AI agents working together autonomously, anyone in any department can focus on the work that matters most. Learn how ServiceNow puts AI to work for people at servicenow.co.uk.
Get a first look at tomorrow morning's front pages. Tonight from 10 with Carol Walker on Times Radio.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
All of your health news in this half an hour of the programme. We will return to the story of Peter Murrell's fascinating shopping list after 3 o'clock. And the footballing legend John Barnes joins us after 3:30 this afternoon as well. We love getting your messages, all different colours, all different tones, all different WhatsApps. 0333 003 2353 is our WhatsApp number. Now, half of all boys between the ages of 11 and 16 are now exposed to harmful messages online about masculinity. This is coming from new research released with the Football Associations of the UK. And they say that sport and sport coaches can often be a place where boys can escape those pressures and confide in adults. They also warn that many of those involved in sport lack the training or resources to actually help, though. So let's talk to Josh Paul, who's a grassroots football coach and runs the Fit for Football Academy. Josh, a very good afternoon.
Hello, how are you?
Yes, well, we're very well, thank you. And you sound buoyant and you sound fit for football, if I may say so.
I have a busy afternoon of sessions out in the lovely weather up until 9 p.m. So I'm getting myself ready for those.
OK, well, it's good to see that you're still wearing your waterproof indoors.
Yes.
Josh, can I ask you how you feel about the place that you hold in a boy, a young man's life with regard to these huge issues?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I take it with great, great, great seriousness, and I really value the need for a positive role model, certainly as a coach. I think if we go back to our childhood, certainly me in my childhood, and I'm sure all the listeners and people that are going to listen to this will agree with me. If you played a sport when you were growing up, your coach is someone that you will never forget. Sometimes for a good reason, sometimes for a not so good reason. So it's really important that the experience that a young child has or a teen has in those years are really positive, and that they can feel comfortable in that environment to speak with the coach about things that might not even be relevant to the sport. Because if we look at a child or a youth, they pretty much have three people in their lives of an adult nature that they can speak with, one of which is their parent, the other is a school teacher, And the third is an outside voice. Might that be a mentor through sport or through playing an instrument or something of those things. So it's really important that us as coaches and mentors can assist and play such a huge role in the child's life.
Sure. How long have you been coaching, Josh?
I've been coaching now since 2007. So I finished school and I went straight into an FA regulated coaching course, which was brilliant for me. And then from that moment onwards, I've been coaching. So coming up to 20 years, which is gone very quickly.
Right. You don't look old enough, but I will believe you. In that time, Josh, have you seen a difference in the attitude that young boys have towards masculinity? Because obviously over those 20 years, that is exactly when we've seen the explosion of access to these horrendous figures within the manosphere.
Yes, and it's really interesting because something that I speak about is over the last 3 years, I have had to become a therapist, a mentor, a coach, a shoulder to cry on, and a million one other things within a football session, which is very different to when I first started. You know, when I first became a coach, it was, you were a football coach, and that's brilliant. But I think as times go on and as these children have more of an impact from outside noise, it does creep into their everyday life, and they show that through when they come to a football session. So in answer to your question, I have seen a huge change from 2007 up to probably around 2020, where in which children would come to sessions with problems, but those problems would be very, very offline. So it might have been a feud with a friend at school, or it might have been a detention that overran that the child is stressed about, or something that's going on in their personal life with their family. But now children are coming into sessions, and after spending 3 or 4 hours on their phones, their head is filled with this doubt, this worry that we didn't have maybe 5, 6 years ago.
So do you feel that you have been well enough prepared in order to deal with that?
So I've gone out of my way to go and read lots of books and study the extra things required to help a child, which aren't really that well documented. When you sign up to become a football coach, you sign up to coach the sport of football. But what you learn very quickly is when you are with a child in that environment, they are opening up to you because they feel comfortable, because they are enjoying what they're doing, because they trust you. So I think that the help is out there. It's certainly out there. We can go and find it, but it's not as accessible as it needs to be. And I do feel that with the EE mentor badge, which is the thing that I have really helped with over the last 2 months, help create, which is now out, that is something where people can go and they can find out this information, which is helping with the bigger problem, which you've spoken about already. Which
sure. So what's included in that? What kind of pointers do you get?
So it's things about recognising the silent signals, right? Because if a child is struggling, often they won't just come straight out with it. There's a huge, huge, huge thing at the moment with the younger generation around holding problems in, not being too vocal about them. So what the mentor badge does is it helps coaches and people working with children spot the signs early. So that's things like behavioural changes. It's things like the language that they might be using. Are they using negative language, or are they using language to bring other people down and bring themselves down? It's things like body image as well. Is a child coming into a football coaching session or a session of any sort worried about their body image and overlooking, judging themselves in comparison to other people too much? These are all silent things that are hard to pick up on, but if you recognize the signals and start to understand what to look for, they are easier to spot. And I do believe that as coaches and teachers and mentors and anyone that works with children, we have an added job thanks to social media, because what social media is doing is it's growing at such a rapid speed that we need to catch up as teachers and mentors and coaches to be able to help with the problems that social media is essentially going to cause.
I mean, in football, you've got some very good examples of positive masculinity, haven't you? Gareth Southgate, yeah. Declan Rice, Harry Kane. It's a decent list these days. You've got some absolutely horrendous plonkers, so I'll only name Joey Barton there. But I can imagine, and I suppose I say this as a parent too, it is sometimes more tempting for younger kids to emulate bad behaviour than good behaviour. I mean, that's just a fact of life, isn't it? So I wonder how you deal with that.
Well, it's a brilliant observation, and it's something for sure that's not just happened recently, but if I look back to when I was younger, in the early 2000s, when I was, you know, a teenager, everyone wanted to try and bring in the new trend back then, but it wasn't as easily accessible. So, you know, you might have seen a quote on a film, or you might have been watching a TV series where a character might have been acting a certain way, in a masculine way, and that would then be transcended and carried into everyday school life. But now, like you've just said, all you've got to do is kind of go onto social media and you're exposed to these people that have a negative outlook on life, and they're trying to impose their views of how they feel a young boy should be and a teenager should be. And children and youths are so easily influenced that they often lack their own identity. So they try and latch onto an identity that they might have seen online. So how do you diffuse that? I think it's by being a consistent, positive voice in their ear. I say to anyone that asks me about what I do, I am there for when you come to one of my sessions to tell you that you are okay, that you are enough, that you don't have to compare yourself. I must have made 1,000 videos talking about how you mustn't listen to opinions and how you shouldn't compare yourself, because they're the things that these children need to hear, because it's so tempting to compare yourself. It's so tempting to listen to opinions, but it's about understanding in those hours that you have with the child that you've got to be as positive and uplifting to them as possible, to let them understand that they don't have to seek validation from anyone online. They don't have to be body conscious. They are okay just as they are. And that's the broader message. And guess what? Anyone can deliver that message. You don't have to be a doctor to deliver that message. You don't have to be a psychiatrist. You don't even need to be a coach. You just need to be a human and understand what's going on social media.
Do the boys still play alongside the girls? And if so, up to what age?
So we like to mix it, yeah. I mean, everyone's got a different opinion on that. I tend to have girls up until the age of 16 play with the boys. I know that some leagues like to limit it and go slightly younger. But I do believe that they should be playing with each other right up until they finish school.
And how does that pan out?
The girls give it back to the boys just as much as the boys give it to the girls. And
that's music to my ears, Josh.
Yeah, and they leave the football pitch all smiling with each other. And you know, it's something that I do. I don't know what other coaches might not do it, but I think that the girls can hold their own against the boys. And as long as I see that and I'm comfortable with that as the coach, and there's no safety kind of regulations getting broken there in terms of physicality, and there's nobody's at danger with each other by playing together, I don't see why they can't play together up until they're 16 or beyond that. It's up to the coach's discretion, but I tend to cap it off at 16. And also another reason for that is because that's when a lot of mixed teams start to stop and they go into their own gender to play football.
Yeah, I mean, it is hard actually to find mixed teams, I would say, over the age of about 11. I think it's fantastic for them to stay together as long as they can. Actually, it does help to understand, you know, what happens to boys, and it helps the boys understand what happens to girls. But I know sometimes that's not always easy. Josh, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Good luck with the rest of your rather damp training this evening. That's Josh Paul, who's a grassroots football coach and also runs the Fit for Football Academy.
He did look young, didn't he?
He did.
Oh, yeah. I can't believe he's been doing it for 20 years. Right, next, it's the health news this week with Dr. Ellie Cannon. And we're talking actually today about a significant government announcement on prostate cancer screening. That is next. It is just after 3:15. It's Times Radio.
Hugo Rifkind on Times Radio with Elevon. Join Hugo every Monday to Thursday morning from 10 as he takes a sometimes serious and sometimes satirical look at the day's news, politics and culture.
covering all the major stories making the headlines, with in-depth analysis and exclusive interviews. Hugo Rifkind on Times Radio with Elevon. We support all payments for your business. Make one decision today. Visit elevon.co.uk.
Listen to The Times at One for an essential lunchtime roundup of all the stories making the headlines.
There is a certain pleasure in travelling well, in exploring the world deeply at your own pace. With Oceania Cruises, sail aboard intimate, luxurious ships to the most captivating destinations and savour the finest cuisine at sea in an adults-only atmosphere. Because true luxury is about meaning, not excess. Learn more at oceanacruises.com or contact your travel advisor. Oceania Cruises, your world, your way.
You're making decisions that matter to a lot of people. But what about your ideas? Ideas for what you want your money to do. Ideas that need the time and advice they've never been given. At RBC Wealth Management, with over 100 years of expertise, our advisors build plans around your ideas, not just your assets. Ideas happen here. Talk to us at RBC Wealth Management. Capital and any income from it is at risk.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
And we'll talk about the health news in a moment or two, but we thought we should go back to the House of Commons. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, is on her feet talking about the terrible incident which ended in the death of the student Henry Novak.
Give reasonable grounds to review existing exemptions to knife legislation on the grounds of religious reasons and national dress. I know that the Home Secretary wants to halve knife crime within the next 10 years. What message do these exemptions give? Is she honestly going to rule out at least a review?
Home Secretary.
Let me just say to the Honourable Gentleman, as I've said earlier in this debate, our religious freedoms and the arrangements we have are long-standing and have been designed to strike the right balance between religious freedom and public protection. I have said earlier in this debate that the wider question is something that is worthy of serious consideration, which is what I will give to it. But I would want to start that process by discussing with the Sikh community themselves, to knife crime campaigners and also the police about this matter. That, I think, is the right way to proceed rather than launching a formal review, because actually, as the judge found in this case, this was not an act of religious observance. The minute that knife was unsheathed to be used, it became a murder weapon, and the murderer has now faced the full force of the law.
Alex Baker.
My thoughts.
That was the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood. She was answering a question from Cameron Thomas, who is a Lib Dem MP. So sorry about a little bit of confusion there at the beginning of that. But there'll be much more on what's been happening in the House of Commons with John Pienaar here on Times Radio from 4 o'clock. Now to the health news. Now, black men aged between 45 and 74 are going to be invited to get a blood test to check their prostate cancer risk. This is after a backlash over the rejection of a mass NHS screening programme. Ministers have announced an extra £20 million in funding to expand the ongoing screening trial for a community whose members are more likely to die from that disease. Dr. Ellie Cannon is our GP in residence this week. Ellie works for the NHS. Dr. Cannon, good afternoon to you. Can you explain why it's so important that black men do get tested for prostate cancer?
Well, it's very simple, really. So men of African-Caribbean heritage tend to have a 4 times higher prostate cancer risk than other men. So it's incredibly important. We also generally have an issue with all men, that they go to the doctor less than women. So being proactive about screening is really important.
Do we know why black men are so poorly impacted, badly impacted, I'm sorry, by prostate cancer? Why would that be the case?
Well, there'll be many reasons. There's probably some genetic reasons. We know that many cancers, the predisposition for cancers are sort of held within our genes, some of which we all know about already. Those genes will be identified. For example, people talk a lot about BRCA gene mutations, but there's also a lot of other genes that we don't necessarily identify or know about yet. So there'll be some sort of heritage and genetic reasons. There might be reasons, for example, to do with accessing healthcare and perhaps men attending the doctor late. So, for example, we know that sort of in terms of health beliefs, sometimes people of colour find it more difficult to access going to the GP, both men and women, actually, in the way that they're treated and the way that the sort of research is and all sorts of different things. So there'll be genetic reasons, there'll be social reasons, there'll be all sorts of different reasons. But whatever those reasons are, we know that this population is more vulnerable. So it's really positive that we're now looking to actively sort of bring those men in.
Right. But of course, it is an invitation for screening. It's not an instruction. Mm-hmm. Why might some men be a bit reluctant to go for testing?
Well, people are reluctant to have all sorts of screening. So we obviously already offer in the UK bowel screening, which involves doing a poo test at home, and not everybody accepts that. People are allowed to opt in or out of their healthcare, and that includes preventative treatments such as screening. So some men may not want to know, they may not want to go, they may have had bad experiences of healthcare, may not be maybe too busy to get there. Whole host of reasons. The same reasons why women may not turn up for their mammograms or for cervical screening.
Yeah, well, I've gone a bit red, actually. I need to do something about that. It's like you can read my mind. Right, OK, let's... I have to be honest, already people are messaging about this. We do know there's been a big campaign, Ellie, about a screening programme for prostate cancer for everybody.
Yes.
And the government decided that they wouldn't be doing it for every man. Now, what are the arguments against mass screening for prostate cancer?
So screening is really complicated. It's not a zero-sum game. We either do it or we don't if we can afford it. It's really not like that. So the reason that we screen against cervical cancer and bowel cancer, as I've mentioned, is a whole host of reasons, because they have good tests available. The tests are for an early stage of those cancers. When it's picked up, you can treat the cancer. It works in a lot of people. There's very few false positives. So there's lots and lots of reasons why something is a good screening test. And we just haven't had that yet for prostate cancer. We talk about PSA. It's not a great test. We get a lot of false positives. And that's why we don't have screening programs for every cancer. We don't screen for testicular cancer, do we? Or skin cancer. We don't screen for most cancers. We only screen for the ones where there's a really good, robust screening test. And that has what's been the issue with PSA. There are too many false positives. There are too many men who are set on a pathway of lifelong treatment that they may not have needed, that may affect their sex life, that may affect their bladder, may affect their bowel, and therefore their quality of life is ruined simply by having this screening test for a cancer that was never going to affect them. So it's very, very complex.
Yeah, okay. If we can just sum it up, this is not a case of two-tier NHS to link it to another.
Oh, God, no, absolutely not. It's okay. Absolutely a case of screening those people who are higher risk. So it's just incredibly good common sense.
Yep, okay, thank you. That's the voice there of the doctor. So I hope that's got through to some people who are already quite exercised by this. Can we talk about something that potentially sounds positive, a so-called wonder pill that has been found to shrink tumours in certain types of cancer? Six really difficult to treat types of cancer is my understanding. What do you know about this, Ellie?
Yeah, so this is, again, so another cancer we don't screen for, so particularly pancreatic cancer, the prognosis of which has not really sort of changed very much in my entire lifetime. Pancreatic cancer is very hard to pick up, and therefore a lot of people, when they're diagnosed, sadly, are already at a late stage. and therefore you can't have curative treatment. We've talked a lot in the last few years about immunotherapy, and this miracle drug that you've mentioned, I'm not going to try and pronounce the name of it, is a type of immunotherapy. So where the specialists use our own immune system to target the cancer. And this has been shown, particularly in pancreatic cancer and others which are hard to treat, actually really improving survival rates. And I can't emphasize enough how important it is, because these are the sort of Cinderella cancers that really don't get the attention, or not as much the research that they deserve, but there just hasn't been the leaps and bounds that there have been in other cancers.
I mean, I don't want to put the fear of God into anybody, but are there any symptoms of pancreatic cancer that we should be aware of?
Yeah, there are. So if you are diagnosed as having type 2 diabetes, and that's surprising because you're not overweight, then your GP should always be thinking about your pancreas, indigestion that doesn't go away, that isn't explained, feeling sick all the time, unexplained weight loss. You see, they're all sort of quite diffuse, difficult symptoms. Pain that's sort of in the upper tummy that goes through to the back, that's a symptom of pancreatic cancer. But these are all sort of quite diffuse, nebulous symptoms that could be used of different things.
Right, OK. And a brief word from you, if you can. I don't know if you saw last night's panorama on the BBC, it's still on the iPlayer, about the Nottingham NHS Trust, currently at the centre of the largest maternity inquiry in the history of the NHS. We seem to have had so many of these stories, and there really does appear, and I do urge people, if they can stomach it, to watch the programme, to be just a lack of kindness at the heart of some maternity operations. What do you think about this?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Obviously, we've sort of come out of a sort of Ockenden reports and all of these types of things. And I think it's just, unfortunately, some misogyny within healthcare. Obviously, these are all sort of women patients who are being affected. I think there's always a tendency within women's health to assume things are normal. So pregnancy is normal, labour pains are normal, periods are normal. And therefore, people's symptoms, people's feelings, people's emotions tend to get belittled. And by the way, they get belittled by male and female healthcare professionals. Yeah. I'm not suggesting that it's just men who do this at all. And probably the majority of midwives are actually women. But yeah, we do have an issue. Obviously, very high pressure environment, very scary environment for patients, but also for the healthcare professionals. And there's a real problem going on, isn't there?
Thank you very much. That is NHS GP Dr. Ellie Cannon. Nearly 3 o'clock now.
Across the UK, on DAB, on your smart speaker, and now in the Times Live app on your mobile and tablet. This is Times Radio.
It's now 3 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. In the next hour of our programme, 10 grand here, 20 grand there. How did the SNP's former chief executive spend the money he stole? The Times' Scottish political editor has been at Peter Murrell's court hearing. Has Donald Trump fallen out of love with Israel's leader, Benjamin Netanyahu? We'll hear about a screaming phone call. And John Barnes will tell us about England's chances in the World Cup after 3:30. Let's get the very latest news with Rob Malarkey.
Fee, thank you. Good afternoon. The Independent Office for Police Conduct will report the findings of its investigation into Hampshire Constabulary's handling of the murder of Henry Novak within the next 3 months. It's after Sir Keir Starmer had said the police watchdog's investigation must be carried out as quickly as possible, with answers delivered. Novak was handcuffed by police officers just minutes after he'd been stabbed by a Sikh man who'd accused him of racial abuse. Shabana Mahmood, the Home Secretary, also addressed what she called a dangerous undercurrent in the reaction to the case.
Threats against police officers are utterly unacceptable. There can be no justification for intimidation, abuse, or attempts to take the law into one's own hands. A police officer unrelated to this case has been misidentified online and subjected to death threats. He has been forced to relocate to protect himself and his family.
F
Vikram Digwa, who was sentenced to life for the murder of Henry Novak, has appeared in court with his brother and father charged with multiple weapons offences. The High Court in Edinburgh has heard how Peter Murrell, the former chief executive of the Scottish National Party, bought three vehicles with funds that he's embezzled from the SNP. Prosecutors have also set out how he created false invoices to cover his offences. Alan Cameron KC gave details of a motorhome with a luxury interior which had just 4 miles on the clock when it was seized by police.
The total price of the vehicle was £124,550. The accused made three payments totalling £12,500 as a deposit with his SNP charge card. The balance of £112,050 was paid by the accused in four direct transfers from the SNP account on the 7th of December 2020.
At least 18 people are now known to have been killed in what the Russian military said was a massive strike across Ukraine. At least half of the fatalities were in the eastern city of Dnipro, while officials in the capital Kyiv say six people were killed after the collapse of an apartment building. Katerina Malofieva, a journalist in Kyiv, says Moscow had warned last week that it would carry out a large-scale assault.
Our president was indicating about the possibility of the attack. The Western intelligence also suggested that, so people were sort of prepared, but unfortunately still we couldn't avoid the casualties. Six people died in Kyiv and 11 in Dnipro, and the toll is still growing.
UK Athletics has been fined £350,000 over the death of a Paralympian who was killed when a practice cage at a London leisure centre collapsed on his head. Abdullah Hayaye, who was 36 and a father of five, was preparing to represent the United Arab Emirates at the World Athletics Championships in London in 2017 when the cage fell on him at Newham Leisure Centre. The judge at the Old Bailey ruled the cage toppled over because it had been put up incorrectly. South West Water is to be sentenced today after admitting supplying water unfit for human consumption to customers in Devon. It's connected to an outbreak of cryptosporidiosis in May of 2024, with 143 confirmed cases. And Sir Kenny Dalglish says he has been diagnosed with cancer. The Liverpool, Celtic and Scotland great inadvertently posted on social media that he was undergoing treatments, which prompted him to follow up with a lengthier statement. In self-deprecating fashion, he said, "Unlike my mobile phone use, the treatment is going well." For a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times Radio news briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
We are talking about the Middle East. Before 4 o'clock, we're also going to have John Barnes, England and Liverpool great, in the studio, looking ahead to the World Cup and England's chances. I'm going to ask him about Scotland as well, of course. Anything you'd like to put to the great Mr. Barnes, you can let us know. Here's the number, 0333 003 2353. I know not everybody is a mad keen England fan. We take it, we understand. Other people want other things from life, incredibly, other than a World Cup triumph for England. I can't understand it, Fee, but there you go.
Well, don't worry, the tennis is coming our way soon,
isn't
it? Oh,
yeah, tennis. Yes, yeah. We've got tennis. But Tracy is one of a number of people who just wants to say what a great, inspiring young man that football coach that you talked to was.
Yeah, he was lovely.
Yeah, he was.
Do you know what, Jane? He's one of those people that you hope your kids meet. Because he was right when he said, you know, there can be three amazing people in a child's life. Mm. Only one of them is a parent. The other two are teachers. And, you know, you just hope that your kids meet the nice ones.
Yeah, no, he was. He seemed like a great bloke. Well, the former SNP chief executive, Peter Murrell, has been led from court in Scotland in handcuffs today. He has been convicted of stealing £400,000 from the SNP over a period of 12 years. Now, here are just a few examples of where that money went, set out in court today by prosecutor Alan Cameron, KC.
Items from Mont Blanc with a total cost of £24,342.60. Items from Smytheson, a retailer of luxury stationery, leather goods, diaries and fashion products, with a total cost of £24,495.50. Items from Dyson with a total cost of £6,085.86. Items from Le Creuset with a total cost of £5,319.28. Coffee machines with a total cost of £8,991.65. Two of these, Dura coffee machines purchased at a cost of £3,231.90 and £1,865.75 respectively, were found by police at the accused's home.
Right, in full flow there, the prosecutor, Alan Cameron, KC. Well, some of the things that Peter Murrell bought were presents for his wife, Nicola Sturgeon, during her time as First Minister of Scotland. She says that she had no knowledge at all of his crimes. Daniel Sanderson is the Scottish political editor for The Times. So what exactly, Daniel, was going on in court today?
Hi, yeah, good afternoon. So today was obviously Peter Murrell pleaded guilty on Monday last week. So what we had today was an agreed narrative between the prosecution and defence teams, where the prosecution basically ran through an agreed sort of sequence of events from the point at which, you know, the first complaints were made in early 2021 into last week. So it was a summary, really, of what the police investigation has found over the past 4 years or so.
Loads of people are just baffled by all this, Daniel. In many ways, it's an absolutely gripping story. Let's just be honest about it. But how much oversight, if any, was there of what this man was doing?
I mean, I think that's the main thing we learned today, is that basically there was absolutely none, as far as anyone can tell. I mean, we heard that the expense system, he, despite having overall control of the expense system, Peter Murrell was able to just tell his colleagues that he couldn't have access to it, and therefore he didn't need to provide, you know, invoices or receipts as they all did. He would, like, just changed codes of things when, like, he had a SNP credit card, which, you know, you'd expect someone in his position to have, but when he recorded the items, he would simply, you know, change the codes. So, you know, you had these bizarre things like an egg poacher became an Ethernet cable, you know, watches became event merchandise, and it seems like he was just able to, you know, log into the system, enter whatever he wanted. You know, occasionally the auditors would raise questions, and he would just sort of make up fake invoices and send them in. So it just seemed like a system where he had absolute control over the party bureaucracy, and there was no one there to sort of raise, challenge him or question him in any way whatsoever.
Well, of course, he was the chief executive of the party, and somebody who might have challenged him was the leader of the party, but then she was married to him, which is where it gets even more ridiculous.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a wider issue with culture with the SNP. You know, this couple ran the party for years. You know, there were attempts to sort of raise questions. Those people were ostracised and sort of treated as traitors, some of them have said, just for raising legitimate questions. So, yeah, I think, you know, obviously Nicola Sturgeon has repeatedly denied knowing anything about this. I'm sure she'll be sticking to that. But then, you know, some of the things that came out today, like a lot of the items were discovered in their home. So we had a robot lawnmower for their small lawn, which cost about £3,000. The bookcases that, you know, if you saw Nicola Sturgeon on sort of TV, on Zoom interviews at that point, she would always be sat in front of. So, yeah, they're you know, will continue to be questions for her, I'm sure.
Yeah. Robot lawnmowers, I mean, we'd all like one, if we're honest. How much was the egg poacher, just out of interest?
The egg poacher, I have it here. I think it was around £24. So that's the other thing, you know, that list you read start, there's all these, a lot of luxury items, a lot of really expensive, you know, watches and pens and things like that. But there was also a lot of really mundane things, you know, he was buying toilet rolls in that sort of COVID period where everyone was buying toilet rolls, hand cream, you know, really cheap stuff as well. So, yeah, it's a totally bizarre catalogue of items he was buying over 12 years.
I mean, he was what we used to call a bog roll bandit at a time when his wife was appearing on television, urging people not to panic and, for heaven's sake, don't panic buy.
Exactly, yeah. And when you look back, when you look back at a lot of this, you know, he used COVID to justify a lot of these purchases. So like the infamous motorhome, you know, that was meant to be a battle bus to get around COVID restrictions. An earlier car he bought, an electric Jaguar, he justified that to the auditors by saying, you know, this was for a series of events we were going to hold around Scotland that had to be canned because of the pandemic. So yeah, it's quite ironic when you think how much Nicola Sturgeon came to be known for her performance during COVID, and then at the same time her husband was, you know, using it as an excuse for criminality.
Yeah, the motorhome, you had to look at what was on the clock, and it had done how many miles? Just remind us.
It had done in grand total of 4 miles.
Right.
So he picked it up from an industrial estate, drove it to his mother-in-law's house. His mother's house. Mm. Nicola Sturgeon's mother-in-law, and there it sat for over 2 years until the police swooped in and pounded it.
Some people are concerned about the timing of all this. And had this come to court before the elections, do you think there might have been a different outcome? Because we need to remind people, the SNP, they're basically, well, they're back in power at Holyrood, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, originally the plea hearing at which Peter Morrell pleaded guilty was due for February. That was then postponed until last week, which is obviously just a couple of weeks after the elections. Now, you know, a lot of people we spoke to said it's not especially unusual that a hearing like this would be postponed. We understand that came at the request of the defence, but yeah, it does look, I mean, the timing just does look incredibly suspicious and convenient. So yeah, would it have made a difference? I mean, I think it's very hard to see how it wouldn't have. You know, this has been a dominant news story across the UK. You know, no one in the SNP comes out of it particularly well. And yeah, so it would have absolutely dominated the Holyrood campaign. So yeah, it's very hard to see how it wouldn't have had an impact.
Right. You mentioned that people don't come out of it well. John Swinney is a very, very old friend of Peter Morrell. Hadn't they been in the Boys' Brigade together?
Yeah, we had some reporting on at the weekend. I mean, we knew that John Swinney in his first stint as party leader in 2001 was the one who had initially appointed him. But yeah, they go way back. We understand they were, as you say, in the Boys' Brigade together as sort of teenagers. They were then part of a sort of network of SNP activists. You know, this is in a period, remember, where they were far from the sort of dominant force they are today. So in the 1980s, they would be, you know, going around together at party events. They both started working for the party at roughly the same time. So yeah, they go back a very, very long way. John Swinney, you know, clearly no suggestion he had any idea whatsoever what was going on, and now is very keen to put a lot of distance between them. You know, he's saying how utterly betrayed he feels at what's transpired.
Yeah, so he had no inkling, along with Nicola Sturgeon, it would seem. But somebody who did have an inkling was Alex Salmond, and indeed Alex Salmond's wife, who really did not like... I think she's still with us, but Alex Salmond has died. They didn't like the cut of Peter Morrell's jib because he had a bit of form.
Yeah, apparently so. I mean, this is a story that has been going around for a couple of years. Obviously, we haven't really been able to report it with all the reporting restrictions until the guilty plea. But yeah, apparently back in the early days of Peter's career, he worked for Alex Salmond, and there was a suspicion, particularly from Alex Salmond's wife Moira, that some items had gone missing. There's been claims that an amount of cash, you know, in the region of maybe £500 had disappeared, and Alex Salmond had had to sort of repay it to keep him out of trouble. So yeah, there are. And apparently this is something that Alex Salmond was telling people before he passed away. So it does seem that, you know, perhaps he has a bit of form for this. I think we'll find out more in the in the sentencing hearing, where we're going to get the full, you know, mitigation, whether there'll be a, you know, some sort of mental health defence put forward. We don't know about that.
It's a good point. Mitigation will come when sentencing happens, which is on the 23rd of June. And although we can have, and we have had, let's be honest, a titter at all this, because the sort of list of items bought is faintly preposterous, it does hint at slightly, well, more than disordered spending. These are the actions of potentially a rather troubled individual, surely.
Yeah, I mean, like I said earlier, I think it's the smaller items that are sort of hard to explain. And then another thing that came out today, so he bought two watches that cost £9,000. And then when the police raided their home and the SNP headquarters in April 2023, they found two of these watches. Now, that was unusual because Peter Morrell had actually resigned as chief executive the previous month, so it seems like he bought these £9,000 for two watches and then apparently just, you know, left them behind, which seems like a very odd thing to do. You know, it seems like, I think he bought them in 2017, so, you know, we didn't get a full story on the watches, but it sounds like they've just been sat in a drawer for a number of years. And then when he resigned, he didn't even bother to take them with him. So, yeah, it seems very odd, and it'll be really fascinating to see what is put forward as his explanation for doing this, because, you know, the people we're speaking to in the SNP who worked with this guy for years are and continue to be completely baffled about what was his motivation for doing this.
And very briefly, what are the chances of an inquiry? I know people like Jack McConnell, who was a Scottish First Minister, a Labour politician, they've been calling for a joint Westminster Holyrood inquiry. Is that going to happen?
The SNP Holyrood, you know, John Swinney is desperate for there to be no inquiry. That's very clear. And, you know, it's easy to see why they're desperate. Paying this as, you know, one bad apple and not getting to the wider issues of culture. Now, I think if there isn't an inquiry at Holyrood, then it sounds like the Scottish Affairs Committee at Westminster, which obviously the SNP do not control, will launch one. So I think we will see an inquiry in some form, probably more likely at Westminster than in Holyrood.
Thank you very much for your time, Daniel. Daniel Sanderson is the Scottish political editor for the Times. Peter Morrell going to be sentenced on the 23rd of June.
It does smell like addiction, really, doesn't it, Jane? Because it's the thrill of the purchase if you've only got 4 miles on your motorhome clock.
The whole thing is bizarre. But as you say, yeah, I mean, this man is possibly not very well.
So we will talk about the situation in the Middle East in a couple of moments' time after a phone call between Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu went beyond screeching. You're listening to Times Radio. It's nearly 20 minutes past three.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio.
The US State Department hosts talks between Israel and Lebanon. We'll keep you right across any updates. You'll hear more from Peter Morrell about his embezzlement of £400,000 from SNP funds. He returns to the High Court in Edinburgh. We'll cover that with the big political brain of Adam Bolton. And the biggest stories of the day will be analysed by the peerless Michael Binion, former diplomatic editor for The Times, and the always insightful historian Tessa Dunlop.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. That's why it's no surprise that more than 85% of the Fortune 500 use the ServiceNow AI platform. While other platforms duct tape tools together, ServiceNow seamlessly unifies people, data, workflows, and AI, connecting every corner of your business. And with AI agents working together autonomously, anyone in any department can focus on the work that matters most. Learn how ServiceNow puts AI to work for people at servicenow.co.uk.
McDonald's breakfast is turning up the heat with a spicy new twist. Calm down, not that spicy. Breakfast is for savoring, not suffering. Introducing McDonald's breakfast with Frank's Red Hot Ketchup. A spicy breakfast suitable for the morning. Until 8th of June, served until 11 a.m, subject to availability.
Listen live or catch up on shows you might have missed using the Times Radio app for iOS or Android.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
The last year or so has seen Reform go ahead in the polls and stay there pretty consistently. So what lies behind that apparent popularity? The annual British Social Attitude Survey is out today. It sheds light on who votes for Reform. Sir John Curtis, Professor of Politics at Strathclyde University, is the co-author.
It is the ideological distinctive of attitudes towards immigration, towards equality policy, and above all, attitudes towards Brexit, that above all distinguishes Reform voters, and it distinguishes them to a much greater extent than does indeed the fact that they're also relatively discontented.
That is John Curtis talking to Kate and Stig on Times Radio Breakfast, which airs from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. Monday to Thursday.
Do you ever use that expression?
Do I air? I tend not to.
We air Monday to Thursday between 2 o'clock and four. Now, if you enjoy listening to Times Radio, well, why don't you recommend us to a mate of yours? Right now, you can even win, you and your friend, a pair of £100 John Lewis vouchers. Just go to thetimes.com/referafriend, enter your details and your friend's details too, and include a message to say why you think they'll love Times Radio. We've had loads of messages from you, so thank you very much. Here's just one of them. Emma Sanders recommended her friend James. I love listening to Times Radio as it keeps me informed about current events, she wrote. The presenters are knowledgeable and easy to listen to. I know my friend James would love a well-balanced station covering all the latest news. So here's that address again, thetimes.com/referafriend. You and your chum could be in with a chance of winning a pair of £100 John Lewis vouchers. All the terms and conditions are online.
And I'm sure you can say anything you like, really, about Times Radio. You might want to recommend it to a friend because it makes you livid. You need to get your blood pressure up.
Yeah, exactly.
23 minutes past three. Reports of a heated phone call between President Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu have raised fresh concerns about the state of US-Israel relations. The US president is said to have vented his frustration over Israel's military actions in Lebanon, which Tehran said constituted a violation of the ceasefire. Well, let's talk about this with Israeli writer and political analyst Aria Kovler. A very good afternoon from us, Aria. Tell us all you know about this phone call, what it was meant to be about, and what happened in it.
Well, it seems like this was, you know, at least originally scheduled as a call to talk about how the negotiations with Iran were going in the ceasefire, and, you know, the US is trying to cook up with Iran right now. But the focus became Israel's imminent, as it was at the time, renewed campaign in Lebanon. Now, in the last few weeks, Israel has been under attack from Hezbollah in Lebanon. Almost every day at the moment, an Israeli soldier is being killed, civilians too, drones into Israel. Of course, Israel is occupying southern Lebanon and is also attacking pretty heavily what it calls Hezbollah targets inside Lebanon. And there was a sense that enough is enough. Israel supposedly got the green light for a more robust military operation from Marco Rubio. And as soon as they started, Iran went nuts, said, okay, the ceasefire is off. And Trump supposedly called up Netanyahu and really let him have it, said, this is not what we agree. He called him, said, you're going crazy. According to one report, he told Netanyahu, you would be in jail if it wasn't for me. And pretty much put him in his place and turned the jets around midair, calling off a potential bombing campaign in Beirut.
Why does America object so vehemently to Israel's action in Lebanon if it is indeed taking out Hezbollah, which is a direct proxy of Iran?
Well, it's not clear America objects. Again, Israel feels like it essentially asked for and got permission to do this from US officials, including Marco Rubio, but Trump had a different view. Ultimately, it seems that Iran says no ceasefire if Israel is attacking its proxy Hezbollah. And Trump right now seems to want to do what Iran says. You know, it seems pretty clear that Iran is in the driving seat right now in these negotiations. And Donald Trump wants a deal. He wants it soon. He wants to be able to say he made a deal and a good deal. And he doesn't want anyone screwing up for him.
Why do you think Marco Rubio has gone his own way? And is he important enough in negotiations to be able to retract any enthusiastic signs that he was making to Israel?
Well, it seems that Rubio is sort of more of the old guard of Republican foreign policy. A little bit more ideological, a little bit more genuinely worried about perhaps the big picture, and some of the people around him feel the same. Trump, you know, Trump is Trump, and on any given day he may say or feel different things. But you know, the extent to which Marco Rubio is in charge of foreign policy is pretty limited right now. It's Donald Trump, it's the Wyckoff, it's whoever happens to get him on the phone last. And that's just kind of the way the world works now, unfortunately.
Well, I mean, it is. And I really note the resignation in your voice, Aria, when you say, you know, Trump is Trump. He can have a myriad of different opinions across the course of one day. I mean, that's kind of OK if it's grandpa on the golf course, but he's not grandpa on the golf course. He is dictating world events at the moment. I mean, it's quite something when it has come to an acceptance on our behalf of some mighty strange behaviour.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think it would be reasonable to say that the US is losing or has lost this war with Iran. For all the destruction that it has caused to Iran's capabilities and capacities, Iran is in the driving seat. It has closed the Strait of Hormuz. The US is not willing or prepared to open it militarily because Trump never did any of the work that you need to do if you want to fight a prolonged and painful war to the public. You know, before the Iraq war, George W. Bush spent about a year and a half making the case to the American people. And we can talk about how good or bad that was, but he tried. Donald Trump spent about, you know, 4 or 5 long posts on social media explaining why he thought this was a good thing. And there's just not the will of the public, but either in the US or in the world, to fight to win. And that kind of meant this was a loser when it began.
And what do you make of the way that Trump then interprets the course of events and the part that he plays in that? Because yesterday we were reporting two extraordinary posts on Truth Social where he basically said, sit back and relax, everything's going to work out in the end. And here we are talking about him having a massive falling out with a very important player in the region, which again, he just spins as nothing to see here. And it's very weird gaslighting for us. And I mean, we can afford to kind of sit back and look at it that way. But for the people of Lebanon, for the people of the Gulf states, for the people of Iran, how does that message land?
Look, there is still in the Gulf states, you know, and in Israel, a kind of a section of the public who thinks that there must be a plan. I mean, you know, it couldn't really be what it looks like. You know, there must be a plan. Must be all we're going. Someone must be behind this, right? It can't really be. The world can't work that way. But the rest of us, and I put myself in the second category, we're pretty depressed about it all. I don't see how things return to any kind of status quo antebellum. This very long post conflict period in Iran. The oil's running out. There are people at a lot of stocks, and we only have a few more weeks before, if the Strait of Hormuz is not reopened, then we start to see global financial crisis. Iran knows that and is able to put a lot of pressure on Trump ahead of the midterms. It's all about, you know, making him feel like he won. But Iran doesn't want to make him feel like he won. They want to make him feel like he lost.
So if I ask you for a prediction of where we all might be in, let's say, 6 months' time, what would you say?
If you had to press me, and this is really a, you know, who knows, you know, ultimately I hate to put it this way, but we're kind of dealing with the whims of a mercurial and unstable person, and no one can really predict that. But if I had to predict, I would say that we end up with some kind of a deal agreed between Iran and the US. It's not a very stable deal. Trump continually insists that the deal says things that Iran denies that it says. No one agrees on what the deal means. And we may well see the strait kind of open and close several times and being back to this cycle of negotiations over the next few months. It's hard to imagine, you know, either a serious US return to a prolonged conflict to overthrow the Iranian regime or peace and rainbows in the next 6 months. I think we could be heading for a very bumpy ride.
Good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed for your time. Israeli writer and political analyst Aria Kovler.
Now, you're listening to Times Radio, and in the next half an hour, we're going to be talking about the World Cup in the company of the England and Liverpool legend John Barnes. That's next. Here are the news headlines just after 3:30.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Good afternoon, I'm Rob Malarkey. The Home Secretary says there can be no suggestion of two-tier policing in the UK. Shabana Mahmood was addressing comments made by Nigel Farage, who said the arrest of Henry Novak for alleged racial abuse just minutes before he died of a stab wound shows that racism is regarded by the police as more serious than murder. Speaking in the Commons this afternoon, however, she also said there had been a dangerous undercurrent in the reaction to the murder, which had led to one misidentified police officer being forced to relocate for his own safety.
A police officer unrelated to this case has been misidentified online and subjected to death threats. He has been forced to relocate to protect himself and his family. Misinformation and inflammatory commentary is making a dreadful situation even worse. We must all together condemn it.
The Home Secretary also said the Independent Office for Police Conduct would report the findings of its investigation into Hampshire Constabulary's handling of the case within the next 3 months. More details of the crimes committed by the former SNP Chief Executive Peter Murrell have been outlined at the High Court in Edinburgh. Murrell pleaded guilty last week to embezzling more than £400,000 from the party. The court heard how he made fraudulent expenses claims and kept many items at the home he shared with the former First Minister of Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon. At least 18 people are now known to have been killed in a series of Russian military strikes across Ukraine. At least half of the fatalities were in the eastern city of Dnipro. And Southwest Water is to be sentenced after admitting supplying water unfit for human consumption to customers in Devon. It's connected to an outbreak of cryptosporidiosis in May 2024, with 143 confirmed cases. For a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
Sunny spells in 3, 2, 1. Pop to Co-op. Get any two packs of 100% British barbecue favourites for £6.50. Like smash burgers and sweet chilli chicken kebabs. Co-op. Owned by you, right by you.
And 6th of October, selected products subject to availability. Co-op Group food stores only. Full times at co-op.co.uk/summer.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Good afternoon. We're here until 4 o'clock. John Pienaar takes over at 4 here on Times Radio. But for the next, 20 minutes or so, we can glory in the company of John Barnes. He's here, Liverpool and England legend. Good afternoon to you, John.
I don't know if you're glorying in the company, but I am. You are in the company.
Yes, okay.
I don't know how much we're glorying in it, but I'm here.
Okay, you did two World Cups for England, 86 and 1990. Yeah.
1990.
And with Liverpool won 3 league titles, the FA Cup and the League Cup with Liverpool as well. He is also the man behind the iconic rap in World in Motion, which is the best football song and loads better than that other dirge that I can't bear to even mention. Here is John rapping on World in Motion by New Order back in 1990.
You got to hold and give, but do it at the right time. You can be slow or fast, but you must get to the line. They'll always hit you and hurt you, defend and attack. There's only one way to beat them, get round.
It's still good, isn't it?
No, because of a proper group. It wasn't an England record. Yeah. It was a New Order with a proper group, so that's why it was great. Not because of us. We can't take the credit.
Oh, go on, take a bit of credit. Yeah, it is. It's a great song. New Order were a brilliant band. You have done a new version because you're working in association with a pub chain, John.
Yeah, we haven't done a new version. It's just you have to go onto the Green King socials to actually see what it is. It's more so. It's just a parody, a play on words. We've not released it. It's not a song coming out because Green King are just encouraging people to go to the pub and support England and Scotland and the other teams that are there. Their tagline is bar, belonging, and relationships and the atmosphere, which is what football is all about. Not just in the World Cup. Mm. Could you think about Anfield 60,000 people.
Yeah.
There are millions watching from the pubs. That's the majority of people do. Yeah. So people really want to just have that atmosphere
and actually,
of togetherness.
Pubs are having a bad time, aren't they? Actually, hospitality generally. So the World Cup offers a real opportunity for people to get out there.
Absolutely. And if you want an excuse to be in a pub at 3 o'clock in the morning, because that's when the football's on, as much as you may use that as an excuse, it'd be a great time.
Yeah.
But I think every time the World Cup or the Euros come around, that's when pubs really come alive, because that's when people get together to support.
But someone like you can't go to the pub to watch an England game, can you? Because you just get mobbed.
Well, I can go to my local pub, which is you know, 800 yards from my house, which is a very small pub in the village. And we went to a pub with 1,000 people in it, as a lot of people do. But I tend to watch football from home anyway. If I'm not at the stadium, I don't necessarily go to the pub to watch football. But it's for football fans who really want to get out there and get in amongst it.
Exactly. Okay, so here we are then. I was looking at the images of the England squad getting on the plane yesterday, heading off to Florida. They didn't do that traditional image on the plane steps, did they? They just got on the plane and presumably took their seats. So that was that.
Yeah, I mean, those days are... I mean, I remember from Alf Ramsey's time back in the old days, and he used to have these flying the flag and getting on the plane and let's go and fly the flag. And those days are over. Players now probably getting on a private plane. We just got on a normal EasyJet plane, we did. yeah, so it's about... Yeah, I mean, the way they actually, if you look at what happens in World Cups now in terms of what we used to do for the media and stuff like that, and used to like have the flag and, you know, the newspapers are there and you made it. So that doesn't happen anymore. Times have changed.
Yeah, it's quite difficult to get to the players, isn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You can't get anywhere near them.
Well, no, they're very, very tightly managed. The question about how England are going to do, it is inevitable. I looked at the odds. You got the French and the Spanish at 5-1. Mm-hmm. Then England are 7-1. Brazil mm-hmm. are 9-1. Mm-hmm. Do you think that those are reasonable odds for England?
Absolutely. You're third favourites. We're not the best team in the world, so we're not number one. As to the odds, I don't know much about odds, but if you want to say who's first favourite, second favourite, third favourite, forget whether the odds should be 4-1, 6-1, 10-1, whatever it is. But I think that we are probably the third best team in the world. So I don't understand odds. I'm not a bettor. So as to whether they're good odds or not, no. But as to whether we are the third best team in the world ranked to win the World Cup, yes, we are. So
okay. And the problem, John, as you know, is about expectation. Let's say England do come third.
Mm.
We all know what the reaction to that will be. It'll be catastrophic. It won't be fair
but
or
I don't
justified.
Know, but why? Because we are the third best team in the world, so why should we win? Because we're English and we're the best. We should win because... No, we have to get over that. You know, we have to get over that. We're not the best team, so why should we win? Now, why shouldn't... If France should be disappointed if they don't win, because they're the best team. So, and I think that, you know, Gareth Southgate maximised the potential to get to the final and then got to the semi-final in one. And I don't think that the disappointment... Yes, the disappointment is raw because, you know, we lost. But I don't think that it was... We weren't too critical of Gareth when he got to the final and lost, because we realised that, yes, we did well to get to the final, and yes, we do want to win, but all you can do is maximise the potential of the team. And I think that that is what Gareth did, and hopefully Thomas Tuchel can do that. But this is a real English thing, to not have enough respect for other people to believe that we should beat them.
And that's what really irritates the life out of other fans, notably the Scots.
And me.
Okay,
yes.
The Scots, I don't blame them. They don't.
No, listen, the Scots won't include no matter what. And I remember when we played in the home internationals back in the 80s, and the home internationals, England, Scotland, Northern Ireland, and Wales, and even to this day you can have Ali McCoy, you can have Scottish punters and Scottish, you know, commentators saying we hate England, we want them to win, and everybody just goes I can't go on television and say I want Scotland to lose, you know, because we have to pretend to support Scotland. So I think that we're being a little bit hard done by our British brothers.
Okay, but let's talk about Scotland then. If they got through their group and progressed from that stage, that would be really impressive, wouldn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, the thing about it is, from Scotland's point of view, I suppose, you know, the expectations on England, but Scotland have realistic expectations.
Yeah.
So therefore, if they get through the group and they can, you know, get to a knockout stage and they lose, then of course everybody wants to win, but they're more realistic in what they expect. But unfortunately, we aren't.
No, we're not. And I include myself in all this. I do have this vague dream. I loved it when the England women won the Euros. That was fantastic. They put a bit of a marker down.
Well, because the women are one the best team in the world, if you like, apart from maybe Spain. So, of course, they should be doing that.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, we are one of the best teams in the world, and it's harder for the men to do it. So, you know, it's difficult to judge the women doing it. So why can't we do it, type of thing? Because the women's team in England are far ahead of the vast majority of the other women nations, whereas the English men's team isn't.
No, and the England women are really well resourced.
Absolutely,
relative to the other
countries and stuff like that. Yeah,
of course they are. Okay, so let's talk then about what would be a decent England performance in this World Cup. Minimum quarterfinals.
However, so this is the thing: when you don't know who you're going to play, That's always a difficult
Let's
thing to do.
Let's start with the group stage.
Yes, so get through the group stages.
Okay.
And then you get to the last 16.
Yeah.
And then you can win that. But then in the quarterfinals, you may come up against France.
Yeah.
And they can beat you. Yes, you can beat them as well. So to expect us, it's a bit like saying we want to have a good FA Cup run. This year, we want to have a good FA Cup run. And in the third round, you play Man City away.
And you don't have a good FA Cup run.
So now with this, we don't know who we're going to play. So we can't say, but the way that the groups are manufactured to make the top teams go through, you virtually know who's going to go through and who's going to avoid each other until you get to the quarterfinals, semi-finals. Okay. But what you then have is you have a something whereby a team who should finish first may finish second, which means that could be a good team who you could play in the next. So you have that dynamic. But I think that the way it's actually, we should be getting to at least the quarterfinals.
Okay. Now, in England's group, you've got Croatia, Ghana and Panama.
Yeah.
These are three games that on paper, I mean, two of them look pretty winnable, but the Croats can be a bit tricky.
Well, they beat us, didn't they, in the semi-final last time. And of course, Ghana, it's going to be hot. And of course, a lot of these teams who are very good, look at Morocco in the last World Cup, when you play them early on, before they have the defeatist mentality because they've lost two, three games, and now, you know, the first game against a small team is always difficult because they don't know that you're better than them because we're all happy to be here, so you play each other. So that's the. So I'm glad we're actually playing Ghana second rather than first, and Panama is the last game. So we should go through in the group, and then after we take it from there.
Okay, now, as for the squad, it's quite interesting. There's been a lot of people speaking out in favour of Cole Palmer and Harry Maguire.
And Phil Foden.
Yeah, shouldn't forget him. David Walsh in The Times, I've got a quote here, says, leaving Harry Maguire at home was an act of borderline lunacy. What do you think?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. And here's the thing. Thomas Tuchel knows how he wants his team to play. And he's the manager. We've made him the manager. And if he decides that the way I'm going to play is not going to suit Harry Maguire, Phil Foden or Cole Palmer, who are we to tell him that he's wrong? What we're telling him is that what we would do if we were in the manager in terms of the way we would play. He's saying, I'm not playing that way, I'm playing a different way. So therefore, I know that they're not going to fit into what I want. So this is what I'm going to do. So for us to then say, he's made a mistake, he should have taken him. For example, if you look at the way he may play, for example, the way Harry Maguire does well at Man United with England is that they defend deep, they defend in numbers, which means that he's a very strong defender. If he's going to push up and play a high line where Harry Maguire hasn't got the pace to play back, then you don't play Harry Maguire. So he knows what he wants to do. So we are no one to tell him that he has made a mistake because he should have taken Harry Maguire because he says, I'm not playing that way, so why take him?
Okay, yeah, but you can imagine, I don't know, let's say it's the third game, they're playing Panama and things haven't gone well. They've drawn against Croatia and Ghana, maybe even lost to Ghana or Croatia. They've got to beat Panama. Someone at the back makes a mistake. Could be big Dan Byrne. You've got to call him big because he's 6'7".
Yeah, he's big. Yeah.
He is big. He makes a bit of a bodge up through maybe not even his own fault, really. And everyone's saying, well, if Harry Maguire wouldn't have done that.
Well, Harry Maguire would. That's why he's not in the squad. And that's why people have criticised Harry Maguire. And who's to say if Harry Maguire wasn't there, he would have been worse? Who knows? I'm not saying he would. So the point I make is the manager always wrong because everybody assumes that if he had done what we wanted, we would have won.
Yeah.
Do you know that? No, you don't. Now, if he did what you wanted, maybe you would have lost 5-0 instead of 3-0. We don't know. But unfortunately for the manager, I've lost, so I'm going to elect to stand up. But we all assume that if he did what we wanted, then we would have won. So, but it's not as if, you know, you'd even Messi or Mbappe out, or, you know what I mean, or Jude Bellingham or Harry Kane.
We are talking Harry Maguire, but no disrespect at all.
No disrespect at all. And as we've seen, he's been criticised in the past. And people have said he shouldn't be in the squad. And I think Harry Maguire is a good player, but I think he has to play in a team which is going to play a particular style of football.
So how does a manager manage the genius of Jude Bellingham? Because he's not always the easiest character, is he? Should he start every England game?
Well, if the manager wants him to start every England game, he should. You know who makes the decisions at Manchester City who starts? Pep Guardiola and Jurgen Klopp at Liverpool and Mikel Arteta at Arsenal. Not the players. They don't decide how we play, who plays, and you have to back them. Mikel Arteta was asked, and he finished 8th in his first year, 8th in his second year, 5th in his third year, and they backed him, they supported him, and he took the decisions. Once you have a situation whereby the players are going to be more powerful than the manager to dictate how we play or who plays, that's a recipe for disaster. So the manager has to be strong enough to then say, I don't care whether you're Jude Bellingham or Harry McCain, I'm going to make the decision, and everybody else has to abide by it.
Yeah, Jude Bellingham's body language, sometimes when he's playing for England, can be a little bit, nobody else is quite as good as me, I'm getting irritated.
Well, that's wrong, because it's about the team. The best team in the world, Paris Saint-Germain, when they had Messi, Mbappe and Neymar, three best players in the world, they won nothing. Without those players, look what they won. It's about the team. And that's what that is what Thomas Tuchel likes. Gareth was different. Gareth looked for the individuals and he massages your ego and he doesn't make bad decisions in terms of, I'll never take Harry Kane off, never take Jude Bellingham off, I'm not going to shout at you. That's fine for Gareth and he did well. Now, Tuchel is not like that. So if you take Thomas Tuchel, you've got to give him the power to say, you do whatever you want to do. But you can't give him the power and then say, A, you've got to pick Harry Maguire and Phil Foden and them, and B, you can't shout at Jude Bellingham or take him off.
Right. Does it take anything away that the manager is German? Does it matter to you?
Well, not if he wins football matches. It'll become an issue if he doesn't.
Like
anything else. So, you know, it's about success. It doesn't matter whether he's a Martian. If he wins, we'll forgive him. That's the way the world is.
All right. Well, I think, I mean, maybe I'm alone. I don't think I'm alone. I'm genuinely looking forward to this. I find myself...
I look forward to every World Cup because hope springs eternal. We always... And, of course, we get miserable after one game. When we don't play well, we all of a sudden go be down in the dumps. But the World Cup always gives us that feeling at the start of the tournament of... happiness and togetherness.
Yeah, it won't last, but let's enjoy it.
Well, let's hope it does. And it has in the past. We've got to the final and the semi-final, and the last hurdle it hasn't worked. But imagine the journey getting to the final. How great was that?
Yeah, no, it was, and we all did enjoy it. Can you take us? I mean, the 1990 World Cup when you got to the semi-final. What was it like? And you ended up coming fourth.
Well, it was interesting because we didn't start off particularly well, and because we had that support and that togetherness. Whereas if you don't start off well these days, as we can see even in club football with managers, and my club, Liverpool, is one of them, where the fans turn against you straight away. Whereas if the fans turned against us, we didn't have the belief in Bobby Robson because things weren't going well earlier on, we'd never have got to the semi-final. But because we had that togetherness, that belief, that humility, the fans still, you know, supported us when we weren't doing well, and that's what has to happen. It's easy to support when you're doing well, but when you're not doing well, that's when they're needed. And unfortunately, in this day and age, as soon as things go badly, everybody else turns against the manager, the players, and, you know, the whole situation just collapses.
There was a dreadful reaction to some of the England players missing a penalty in the Euros final against Italy.
Mm.
What were you really horrified by that? Did it surprise you?
Didn't surprise me at all. Of course not, because that is a very shallow understanding of racial bias by believing that black players can make a difference. They make a difference if they play well. If they don't play well, they're going to get racially abused, as we've seen. So if that's the case, how much support do you really give them when they're doing well in terms of their colour? It's not, because they give you something you like or they're playing well. So we have to change the perception, and we have to change this in society. Football can do nothing about it. So when people talk about Mo Salah, for example, we're going to change our perception of Muslims because Mo Salah's a good player. Now, if Mo Salah was a bad player, that's not going to change our perception. So why do we shallowly think that because he's a good player, everyone's going to change? And now that he's left, do you think people are going to care? So we're putting everything on football to change the ills of the world, which it cannot do. It is a societal problem, and we have to tackle it in society.
When you started playing for Liverpool, I mean, the racism in football then was rife, wasn't it?
Well, it was even worse when I played for Watford to begin with. Liverpool was 1987, I played from 1981.
Right.
And overt racism was... Now, we've stamped out overt racism, so we're not allowed to have racist chants and stuff like that, but it still exists. You know, just look what goes on in society. So why should 90 minutes once a week when you play football make all of a sudden a difference in society? Which it doesn't. It doesn't.
Does it depress you, frustrate you?
It frustrates me when people feel that the solution to the problem is for footballers to make a difference, and footballers can't make a difference. Footballers can make a difference within the stadium for 90 minutes, because if you're any racist chance, you're going to get kicked out. So if you're a racist, you keep your mouth shut. Are you not a racist anymore for the other 7 days of the week, 6 days of the week? So, you know, we're not really... We have to tackle it in society, and all walks of society will then follow, not the other way around. So, but we're just leaving it to football to make an example, and everyone else washes themselves up then saying football's doing enough.
Taking the knee didn't work for you.
Of course not. How can it work? How can it work? Because taking a knee is going to say, oh, I'm a racist, but taking a knee, I'm not going to be racist anymore. You can highlight it, but after highlighting it, we've got to do something else. We have to educate people. We have to come up with something to make them know why it's wrong to racist abuse, rather than saying, as long as you keep your mouth shut, you can be as racist as you want, because there are other ways to show your bias without actually voicing it. So, you know, it's a very complex subject, which we're trying to simplify by saying keep your mouth shut and everything's okay.
Yeah. Can we talk a bit about Liverpool and the fact that they got rid of Slot last weekend? Wasn't a big surprise, but it kind of was, because they didn't used to be that sort of club.
Well, fans didn't used to be like that either. Fans used to support, whereas now fans want a quick fix. So if it doesn't work, let's get rid of him. And I don't want to get like Manchester United, because Liverpool, not just Liverpool, football clubs, owners, hierarchies, chief executives, board of directors do not fire managers, do not sack managers. Fans do. Once the fans lose faith in you, as much as I'm sure Liverpool would have wanted to have kept him if the fans still backed him, Mikel Arteta finished 8th in his first year at Arsenal, 8th in his second year, 5th in his third year, but the fans backed him still, and look what happened. Now, after winning in his first year and then finishing 5th this year, we're too quick to then all of a sudden. Now, if you look at what Man United did when Ferguson left, David Moyes came after 1 year, we sacked him. A great manager came after that, Louis van Gaal. Lived in the past, Ferguson would have done this, let's get rid of him. Jose Mourinho, they ended up with seven managers.
So many managers.
Now,
yeah.
We don't want Liverpool to go down that stage, because this new manager coming in, suppose he loses the first two matches, so are we going to sack him because he doesn't do that? We have to forget Jurgen Klopp. Man United had to forget Alex Ferguson. Arsenal had to forget Arsene Wenger and give the new manager an opportunity. Or is he going to end up just sacking manager after manager after manager if you keep thinking, well, Jurgen Klopp wouldn't do this, we want Jurgen's way back?
I know that you played with Kenny Dalglish, didn't you? And then he was your manager at Liverpool.
Yeah. I never played with Kenny, no. He signed
me. Signed you. From, who did he sign
Watford.
You from? From Watford.
Yeah.
So it's sad news today that he is, and he admits himself in a very humble way that he's inadvertently announced that he's got cancer.
Well, when he gets Kenny's about 10 years older than me, but he's not a problem dealing with my phone and pressing things and pressing the wrong number and phoning the wrong people and putting out the wrong messages. So Kenny inadvertently let it leak that he has cancer. And he's having treatment, and but you know, some of us have known for a while, but he's dealing with that. As was Kevin Keegan. It came out yesterday, but Kevin Keegan had this problem from January. It didn't come out then, and he's obviously on the mend. He's getting much better, but a lot of people would have read about Kevin Keegan yesterday and thought Kevin Keegan's got stage 4 cancer, but he's coming out of it, and hopefully Kenny will be okay as well.
Yeah, I know there's a lot. I'm from Liverpool. There's a lot of affection for the Dalglish family because of his wife Marina.
Absolutely, what she went through as well, and the support they give.
Yeah, she went through breast cancer, and there's the Marina Dalglish Centre,
right.
And yeah, all sorts of things. So they're a very well-loved family, so I'm
absolutely
sure they'll be looked after.
Oh, 100%. And of course, you know, fingers crossed, and I'm sure they're getting through it, so God willing, he'll be okay.
Yeah, he is the sort of person you imagine would give cancer a good seeing to, if you got the chance.
Yeah, well, you need the support and the help.
Yeah, and actually, news today, John, that the NHS is offering prostate cancer screening to black men in this country between the ages of 45 and 74.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that?
Well, it's a bit of a taboo. I've had prostate cancer. I've had my prostate out. Not many people know. And it's a bit of a taboo subject because we support women with breast cancer, and it's a bit of a, it's not even an issue. Whereas with men, to come and say you have prostate cancer, we need more awareness. We need people to come forward, and in black men, it's more prevalent. Men have to then bite the bullet and swallow their pride and admit if they have problems and see it. So it's a good thing that has come out.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important that the government has acknowledged that although there won't be a mass screening program, they will offer tests routinely to
black men. And I suppose once the stigma is now taken out of it because you've lost your virility and you haven't got that, you know, you haven't got the testosterone in another man anymore, and men feel that way anyway for thousands of years, which is why the world is in the state it's in. That's why women should rule the world.
Too much testosterone. You're talking our language.
Yeah, too much testosterone. So therefore, it's a good thing if we can then come around and admit that we have our frailties.
But you have been outspoken on this subject, and actually you're right, there aren't very many men who are prepared to say, look, I don't have a prostate anymore. Would you mind telling us what impact it has had? I mean, you feel well, you look great, are you all right?
I'm fine. I had my PSA and I've got, so everything is okay. You know, the thing about it is that a lot of men don't want to admit it or want to have it done because it makes them feel less than a man, but you're not, you know, you're exactly the same, you're the same person, and you're around.
And that's
really, the main thing. And for people who love you and want you to think about you rather than being the virile man that, you know, you may feel you're not anymore, your family and the people who love you and your friends really want you here, regardless.
Well, for any man listening who is thinking, oh, God, I could get one of these call-ups for the prostate screening, I'm not sure I want to go. It's not the invasive procedure it used to be, is it?
Well, no. I mean, eventually you do a PSA test and you can have a urine sample, and, of course, your PSA could be high, which means nothing. You can have a high PSA, but the definitive test is obviously the test that isn't particularly nice. But, of course, if you get to that stage, then, you know, because a lot of men who die, they die with prostate cancer. They don't die from it. They die autopsy, you've had prostate cancer. And they didn't even know, because it doesn't have to kill you. You know, so that shows how many men have actually been tested, because a lot of men don't want to do it. So I have two doctors in the family, my kids, and they said, get yourself in there, get checked a few years ago. And obviously the outcome was what it was. And particularly in Africa, Caribbean and black men, it's probably higher. So, you know, my kids forced me to do it.
I love the idea of you being completely enthralled to your kids who just tell you what to do. That's fantastic. I was watching, like any sensible person about to talk to John Barnes, your goal against Brazil back in 1984 on YouTube. Do you ever look at it?
No.
I've seen it.
I was there. I don't have to watch it again. I was there. I remember it. But in fact, when I watch it, I don't remember doing that, because it was always having an out-of-body experience, because you don't really remember what you're doing. It's like if you watch a boxer knock somebody out, they can't really remember. They knocked him out and we saw what is a left hook or a right hook. But when you're boxing, so in football, it's the same. When you dribble around someone, you don't really know what it looks like, because, of course, when you see it on television, bird's eye view, you can see everything. You can see where he's going. Whereas all you're doing when you're playing football is you've got this vision of somebody right in front of you, and you're doing what you do. So you don't really get the beautiful picture that people see of the whole thing of what you've done. So it looks better than it felt, put it that way.
Yeah, okay. Wouldn't it be amazing, though, if Saka, for example, scored a goal like that against Brazil in the World Cup?
In the final to win it for England.
How about that, John?
Let's get through the group stages first.
Okay, yeah, no, you're very... Yes, you're sorry.
I've got a funny story about that.
Have
if you give me 10 seconds. Neil Ruddock tells this story about when he was at Southampton.
Yeah.
And he was Jimmy Case, who played for Liverpool.
Oh, I know Jimmy
Liverpool
Case.
TV. He went to Southampton. So he's played for Southampton. And then Southampton playing at Liverpool, the European champions, the best team in the world. And Neil Ruddock says to Jimmy, he goes, Jimmy, you know when you get a corner and you're going to put the corner in? He goes, I'm coming up for the corner. Will you put one hand up to let me know you're going to hit it to the far post and two hands up for the near post? Jim Case looked at him and he said, let's get a corner first.
Thank you very much.
So rather than thinking about World Cup final Saka scoring, let's beat Croatia first and get through the group.
All right, John, you put me in my place, and good to get Neil Razor Ruddock on Times Radio. I think that might be a first. John, really good to meet you. Thank you very much. It's Times Radio, 4 minutes to four.
Times Radio Market Watch, in association with Eden Tree Investment Management. Elevate your specialist knowledge with Times Radio's essential roundup of the latest financial news from all the global stock markets. Hear analysis, credible insight, and up-to-the-minute information to help maximize your investment portfolio. Market Watch, throughout the day on Times Radio, in association with Eden Tree Investment Management. Sustainable investing, elevated. Search Eden Tree to find out more. Capital at risk.
Listen live or catch up on shows you might have missed using the Times Radio app for iOS or Android.
Listeners, we interrupt the airwaves to share an incredible discovery. The reason why Britain hasn't been so great of late is because the country hasn't been eating enough Weetabix. We must get to work in rebuilding Great Britain, Bix by Bix. By delivering Weetabix to whoever plans the traffic diversions, to delivery drivers who can't seem to find your house,
and people who don't stack the dishwasher properly.
To Britain, we must say, have you had your Weetabix?
At Ben & Jerry's, we had a thought. Our cookie dough ice cream is already loaded with chunks.
It's a classic for a reason.
But we wondered, could we make it even more cookier?
Go on.
The best way to top it was to bottom it.
Let's just clarify, that's with cookies.
Introducing the new Ben & Jerry's cookie dough ice cream sandwich. Our legendary ice cream packed with cookie dough chunks between soft vanilla and cocoa marbled cookies. No spoon needed.
More ways to enjoy cookie dough. Count me in.
The new Ben & Jerry's cookie dough ice cream sandwich.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Well, I think we all feel a bit more optimistic now, but realistic at the same time.
Exactly, Fee.
Yeah. But nevertheless, seeing Saka weave around the hapless Brazilian defence, it could happen.
Well, just dream it.
Not dream it, dream it, dream it. Okay. Manifest it, darling. Okay. Tomorrow, a completely different guest for you. It's always variety on the afternoon bus, isn't it? Joanna Cannon is in to talk about her latest novel, which is called An Unlikely Visitor. It's quite an extraordinary novel because throughout the entirety of it, one of the main characters integral to the plot is actually dead. And I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to discuss that here. Now, it would be very difficult to do a half an hour interview without mentioning that fact. So I hope you can join us for that. Our producer today was Felix Forbes. Our technical operator was Ryan Boyden. Up next, it's John Pienaar with Drive. Enjoy your evening when you get to it.
Across the UK, on DAB, on your smart speaker, and now in the Times Live app on your mobile and tablet. This is Times Radio.
Thank
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. The Home Secretary says there can be no suggestion of two-tier policing after Nigel Farage's comment in the wake of the murder of Henry Novak. And at least 21 people have died in Russian strikes on Ukraine, many in the eastern city of Dnipro. And coming up, I'm going to be talking to a former senior police officer and the chair of the Independent Scrutiny and Oversight Board about what the case says about policing. And as Hungary reportedly dropped its opposition to Ukraine's membership of the European Union, we'll look at the remaining hurdles standing in the way of membership.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Rob Malarkey.
John, thank you. Good afternoon. The Home Secretary says police officers have been subjected to death threats after the murder of Henry Novak. Shabana Mahmood told MPs this afternoon that one officer who was not involved in the incident had been forced out of his home after he was incorrectly identified as one of those present. Vikram Digwa, a Sikh man, had attacked Novak with a ceremonial dagger in Southampton last December before telling police officers that the 18-year-old student had racially abused him. She also rejected claims by Nigel Farage that racism is regarded by the police as more serious than murder.
There have been accusations, I know, of two-tier policing. It will be for the IOPC to determine the facts with regard to this specific case, and I cannot and will not comment on them. But let me say this on the question of preferential treatment more widely. The police in this country have a sacred duty to police without fear or favour. Everyone in this country is equal before the law.
The Reform UK leader said the arrest of Novak for alleged racial abuse minutes before he died of a stab wound was proof of two-tier policing. And he's been accused by the Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, of whipping up anger and division. Reform's policing and crime adviser Colin Sutton says policing culture has to change.
Put on one side the appalling act of the police officers that turned up. We need to look at why did they act in that way. How did we get from a position of those young officers joining the police to a stage where it's been instilled in some that they must deal with allegations of racism in a way that perhaps doesn't warrant it?
At least 21 people, including two children, are now known to have been killed in what the Russian military said was one of its largest assaults against Ukraine. At least half of the fatalities occurred in the eastern city of Dnipro, including a child and an emergency worker. Katerina Malofieva is a journalist in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv.
Rescue works are still ongoing because it was like, I think like six districts of Kyiv were under the attack, so a lot of buildings are still, they're damaged, and the rescue are still continue a rescue work over there. They keep bombarding the civilian population.
Moscow had warned last week that it would carry out a large-scale assault. More details of the crimes committed by the former SNP chief executive Peter Murrell have been outlined at the High Court in Edinburgh. Murrell pleaded guilty last week to embezzling more than £400,000 from the party. Nicola Sturgeon, who's estranged from Murrell, says that he deceived and betrayed her when he used party funds to buy luxury goods. Prosecutors have today set out how he created fake invoices to cover his offences. UK Athletics has been fined £350,000 over the death of a Paralympian who was killed when a practice cage at a London leisure centre collapsed on his head. Abdullah Hayaye, who is 36 and a father of five, was preparing to represent the United Arab Emirates at the World Athletics Championships in London when the cage fell on him at Newham Leisure Centre in 2017. The court ruled the cage toppled over because it had been put up incorrectly. And Sir Kenny Dalglish says he has been diagnosed with cancer. The Liverpool, Celtic and Scotland greats inadvertently posted on social media that he was undergoing treatment, which prompted him to follow up with a lengthier statement. For a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times Radio news briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow. Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. The murder of Henry Novak was appalling. The police response, abysmal, crass. And the fallout has ignited a wave of political soul-searching, point-scoring and recrimination. Police wrongly treated Novak as a racist offender when they arrived at the scene of the attack, cuffing his hands while he lay dying on the ground of multiple knife wounds inflicted by his attacker, Vikram Digwa, a Sikh. Now, Digwa has now been jailed for a minimum of 21 years, and the case ranks like the murder of black teenager Stephen Lawrence in 1993, which highlighted violent racism, and that of the 10-year-old gang violence victim Damilola Taylor in 2000 as a case which defines the social challenges of our time. Now, the question has become, has fear of being judged racist grown so strong it could blind police officers at a crime scene to the truth of who's the victim and who's the violent offender? So blind that an innocent 18-year-old died handcuffed on the ground while his killer lied about being racially abused to escape the consequences. It has been debated by MPs in the Commons today. And on today's show, I'll get the thoughts of police veterans and politicians, including Reform UK's Danny Kruger, whose party leader Nigel Farage has claimed that Britain is now afflicted by anti-white prejudice and who's called for a national reaction of pure cold rage. Now, for that, Farage was accused by the Tory party leader Kemi Badenoch of tribalism and reinforcing differences. Now, many others, including some of you, our listeners, have reacted with rage. So tell me what you think. Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. So, earlier on, speaking in the House of Commons, the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, condemned the murder of this 18-year-old Henry Novak as an evil act. And she told MPs the murder shouldn't be allowed to drive communities apart.
Yesterday, the Novak family ended their statement with a powerful call to us all. I quote, "We do not want his death to be used to create further division, hatred, or tension." They quoted the words of the prosecuting lawyer. And I quote again, Mr. Speaker, "This is not a case about Sikhism. This is not a case about racism. This is a case about murder." I echo those words. We cannot allow this murder to turn communities against one another. We must condemn those who seek personal political profit from tragedy. Instead, we must show who we really are in this country. This was a murder, a vile and violent crime. The punishment must be reserved for those who are responsible for the act. We do not believe in collective punishment in this country. Instead, we stand together against an act of pure evil. We condemn those who committed this heinous crime, not all those who share their faith or their ethnicity.
Now, the Home Secretary responded to calls to tighten the rights of the Sikh community to carry ceremonial knives.
The Offensive Weapons Act of 2019, passed under the previous government, clarified and strengthened existing legal protections in relation to long kirpans. This included extending defences so that kirpans can be lawfully possessed for religious reasons and used in religious and ceremonial contexts. But let me be clear. Carrying a knife for the purpose of religious observance is one thing. Using it, as so tragically occurred in this case, is quite another. It is a vile act.